is very timely. And we sang this song, I Believe. The subtitle of that song is The Creed. So those lyrics, if you didn't catch that, were from the Apostles' Creed. And they really went through the foundations of the Christian faith. I believe. James had belief running through his heart this morning. Pastor Eddie's been really stirred about belief. And so we're kicking off today, I Believe, week one. And I got to start at the very beginning. I believe today in God. So we're going to talk about why and how do we arrive at that. And so I want to give a disclaimer. I'm going to walk you through the four major questions of life that help us develop a worldview and why the Christian faith answers those four questions better than any other worldview. And then I'll come into maybe how I personally really began to believe in God. So these four major questions, I think they help us develop a worldview, but they're not always the reason we believe in God. It's not like we sit every night, you know, pondering life's greatest, deepest questions and then formulate a belief in God and then go from there. Usually, we're a wreck. You know, and our emotions are destroyed. Our girlfriend broke up with us, and we need help, and God meets us. And there's an experiential, you know, nature to our encounter with God. And so I want to say that because I don't want to start going through, you know, these deep questions, and you're like, this is not how you know, came to belief. You know, no, but it helps us stay grounded and rooted. And especially when we sit in a class and a professor blurts out something that is contrary to our belief and we get kind of confused, these questions and these answers from the Christian faith really help us stay grounded. And so we're just going to walk through them this morning. My text this morning is from two verses. Psalm 14, verse 1 says this, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God." Think about that. That's a strong word. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They're corrupt, their deeds are vile, there is no one who does good. You know, and Paul even says in the New Testament that it's so evident that God is there. And he echoes this verse to say it's very simple-minded to say that God does not exist. And it's really interesting because to say that, you have to know everything. The word atheist means, the statement said, there is no God. But to say that and it be true, you must know everything. That's some high ground to stand on. Now, if you know everything, all knowing, you would be the definition of God. So you just killed your own statement. But the smartest person in the world today, the highest IQ, I think his name is Chris Langdon or something, they say he only knows about 1% of what there is to know in the world. The smartest. And he said it's mathematically possible to prove there is a God. Just a side note. But you can't really say there's no God if you don't know everything. And that's why the Bible says it's foolish. Hebrews 11:6 says, without faith, it is impossible to please God. Because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Anyone who comes to him must believe he exists. You know, a worldview, as I said, is built upon basically four questions that are answered. We have a lot of questions that come to the surface in the course of our lives. But if you categorize most of life's deepest questions, they will all fall into basically four arenas. And that is origin, meaning, morality and destiny. Or what I like to add to that is hope. What about, you know, when we die, but what about our destiny before we die? And so origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. Most every question can be categorized in one of those four. And so let's take the first one, origin. We hit a lot on this. I don't know how long ago it was now in our Q&A series where you guys text in questions, we categorized them, and we then did a Sunday talk and discussion on them. And so we talked a lot about this. You know, how do we know there's a God? Where did everything come from? Why is there a universe from nothing? Sorry, you know, Stephen Hawking, gravity is not nothing. That was basically the premise of his book. A universe from nothing was gravity caused it. But gravity is not nothing. You know, that's a law of nature that we still can't figure out why it's there. And so where do we come from? How did all of this get here? We answered all that stuff. So I don't want to hash through all of that. I'm glad to talk with anybody, or really Eddie and Blake are glad to talk with anybody after this. But what I do want to do is just quote some of the brightest scientific minds of our time. And regarding this, and I love honest atheists. I really do, because they help me a tremendous amount. But how do we get here? First, the Christian God. See, when I say I believe in God, I'm talking about the Christian God. But the title wouldn't sound quite as nice. I believe in the Christian God. So we just say I believe in God. But I'm talking about the Christian God. The answer, the Christian answer to origin. The Christian God provides the most satisfying and reasonable answer to the great question, how do we get here? The Bible says, in the beginning, God, and God created, okay? And that is the answer. Now, what some of the brightest minds in our time have said, Fred Hoyle, who was, I'm not even going to try to describe what he does, but a common sense interpretation, we got this right again, of the facts suggest that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics, as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. You see what he's saying? That what we study and learn in science is so incomprehensible that it just happened, that it appears that some super intellect or divine nature outside of the universe has monkeyed with everything that we study. That's pretty powerful. Sir Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the DNA molecule, said this: an honest man armed with the knowledge available to us now could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. They sound like they're quoting the Bible, don't they? And Stephen Hawking, in his, you know, famous for his book, A Universe from Nothing, he said, a point of creation would be a place where science broke down. One would have to appeal to religion and the hand of God. That's honest stuff. With somebody who holds a commitment, a firm commitment, that there must not be a God. The best explanation apart from God is simply this: I don't know. I have no clue. But the Christian God and the Bible that we study and the God that we serve has told us that in the beginning, there was God. Outside of time and space, and he created. And I'm telling you, the deeper you look into finding answers for this, it is the most reasonable and satisfying explanation there is for where in the heck we came from. All right, just to take this a little further, it would seem that really the unbelief in God in the face of evidence would have more to do with the will rather than observation when it comes to some of these scientists and some of our professors. It really seems to be more of a will that chooses not to believe than it has to do with evidence and observation. What I mean, Thomas Nagel said, I want atheism to be true. I'm made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just the fact that I don't believe in God and naturally hope I'm right. It is that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. Again, that's some really honest stuff. Aldous Huxley took it even further. He said, I wanted to believe the Darwinian idea. I chose to believe it because it delivered me from trying to find meaning and freed me to my own erotic passions. Most of the students that I have worked with and begin to really question their faith, when we get down past all the surface, all the front, you know, the layers of, well, I'm questioning this, my question, when it really gets down to it, it's, I want to do what I want to do. And God is too restricting on my will. And so they want to party and they want to do whatever. And they run to these people in these weird places on the internet to find just one little thing. Like, yeah, that's a good statement. And, yeah, you know, I'm just questioning God now. But you're partying every weekend. You know, like, you've totally changed. You're just different. And it has more to do with the will, I believe, than it does anything else. So what about the second one? I said meaning first, and we'll take morality first because that's in the notes first. Origin, morality, then meaning. Morality, how do we know what's right and wrong? How do we feel and understand things to be wrong in nature? Essentially, where do we get a moral law from, right? This is the question. Answer, the Christian God provides the most satisfactory explanation for objective moral values, or in other words, a moral law. Nietzsche is very famous for his parable, The Madman, which is where we got the phrase, God is dead, from. And if you've never read it, it's not long. You should read it. It's incredible. I would read the whole thing here, but I don't want to bore you to death. But in his parable, The Madman, the madman in the parable makes this statement. Is there still any up or down? You know, is there still this vertical relationship with transcendence? Do we have any bearing at all? He says, are we not plunging continually? Like we've just lost everything. Since we have stripped God from the equation, we no longer have any foundation to give us direction. And G.K. Chesterton said this. He said, there's only one angle at which a man can stand straight, but many angles at which he can fall. Only one. And he went on to say that the tragedy of not believing in God is that you don't believe in anything, or that you believe in nothing, but the tragedy is you'll end up believing in anything. Is there no up or down? Is there no moral ground to place our feet? And it's amazing that the guy that existentialism has just grabbed onto, Nietzsche, like, what a brilliant guy, God is dead. Yeah. Even he in his parable said, when we do that, we've got a problem. We don't have any grounds to figure out what are we doing, where are we? Are we not plunging continually? Once you do away with absolutes, where do you turn? Where do we go for any type of right and wrong? Well, what we would say today is you just go inside yourself. We are all autonomous, self-law, right? We are all our own self-deciding moral compass. But realistically, nobody can live that way. Because then the morality of Hitler and the morality of Mother Teresa are no different, you see? It's very inconsistent to say, well, law is just derived from within. Not only that, it's very contradictory. Kai Nielsen, an outspoken atheist from Calgary, said this, we have not been able to show, now, hang with me on this, this is very important, that reason requires the moral point of view, or that all really rational persons, unhoodwinked by myth or ideology, need not be individual egoists or classical amoralists. Listen to this. Reason doesn't decide here. The picture I painted for you is really not a pleasant one. Reflection on this actually depresses me. Pure practical reason, even with a good knowledge of the facts, will not take you to morality. An atheist with a naturalistic, materialistic worldview says, this depresses me to admit, but what I believe doesn't answer the question of morality. Reason alone, time, matter, chance, you know, space, protons, it doesn't lead us to morality. Right. So why do we feel evil? Why do we sense right and wrong? The question's still unanswered for them. Richard Rorty, an atheist and professor at Princeton, said, if moral imperatives are not commanded by God's will, what we wish to be is a matter simply of what men and women decide should be. There is no other source of judgment. Bingo. Atheist, professor, Princeton, hit it on the head. And Bertrand Russell, an outspoken atheist in the 20th century, he said, I cannot live as though ethical values are simply a matter of personal taste. And he found his own views, quote, incredible. And he said, I do not know what the solution is. He's like, I'm committed that there is no God, but the problem of morality still haunts me, and I do not know the answer. Because reason tells me that good and right and wrong is a matter of personal taste, but I can't live that way. And he recognized the inconsistency with his own worldview. Taking away the absolutes leaves us to ourselves. And see, the solution that Russell was looking for was a moral law. And if you pose or posit a moral law, then you are by default positing a moral law giver. Okay? And so if anyone or you ever say that is wrong, you know, if we look at what Hitler did or Stalin or terrorists or whatever that we see that is unjust, when we see that and we say that is wrong, we are automatically saying there is a law that defines right and wrong. And if there is a law, then there is a lawgiver. And that is what the Christian faith tells us. So what about meaning? Where do we find meaning in life? Where do we as humans find our value? This is a hot topic in many universities. You know, all these forums I'll see on podcasts and online is like, what is the meaning of life? It's a question that we wrestle with. The Christian answer. The Christian God has the most unique answer to the question about our value. We are imago Dei, created in the image of God. Genesis 1:27 says, God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. That's really powerful. When you have a moment in your life where you say, am I worth anything? Am I valuable? Where do I derive value from? It is because you and I bear the image of our Maker. And Jesus affirmed this when he said the greatest commandments are to love God and then to love others like you love yourself, because other people also bear the image of God. I don't see any other worldview that really answers this in a satisfactory way. I mean, Buddhism doesn't ascribe to a God. It's you know, empty yourself of everything. And Islam doesn't have, there's no value, there's no creation in the image of God. There's no God the Father. It's just God, the power, the force, the authoritarian. And even people of the Islamic faith are sacrificed themselves for the greater good. There's no value there in human dignity there. And the existentialist, you know, just solves the problem by saying, well, then there is no meaning. But that doesn't really solve the problem, because we still feel depression. We still feel longing. And so just to say there's no meaning, you know, the father of existentialism, Jean-Paul Sartre, said it doesn't matter if it's minutes or years once you've lost eternity. You know, we could die in 5 seconds or die in 50 years. Who cares? We don't have eternity. But that doesn't answer deep down why we long and sense a need for meaning and value. You know, I saw a recent survey from probably 18-year-olds to mid to late 20s. And you know what they found are the top two admitted struggles of the college age and young adult age? The top two struggles to surface were pornography and suicide. Now think about that in regards to meaning. The loneliest moment in our lives is when we experience that which promised us everything and it let us down. And we look for meaning, we long for meaning, and we finally think we get it. And we spend ourselves on it. And it lets us down to where we're lower than when we started. And we long for this, we look for it, we search for it, but only in the Christian faith do we find created in God's image, valued and loved beyond any other thing. What about destiny and hope? These kind of questions are, you know, like what will happen after I die? That rattles in everybody's head starting when they're a kid. My kids have asked that question, and they're little. What happens? Where can I find hope? What's wrong with the world? We sense it. We feel it. We want answers. What's wrong with my life? In Christianity, the answer, the Christian God promises newness where things have gone wrong. And he offers life eternal. He promises newness. So what is wrong with the world? What's wrong with my life? What is the answer? I can provide a new heart. I can provide a new nature. That's redemption. I can take everything that has been wrong and swallow it up, and we can start fresh. That's what Christianity teaches and what Jesus offers. And when it comes to destiny, what happens after I die? God offers eternal life. Starting here on earth. Life eternal. How is that even possible? How can somebody offer that unless they are God and unless they are perfect? 2 Corinthians 5:21 says this, God made him who had no sin to be sin for us. So that in him we might become the righteousness of God. I love that verse. So that in him we might become the righteousness of God. What has gone wrong with my life? I need fixing. What is the answer? And God sends Jesus to stand in our place, to die in our place, so that we can accept by faith his righteousness on our behalf. That's what can fix you. That's an incredible thing. That God would create us and start everything, but then go the extra mile and redeem us where things went wrong. That's real hope. In naturalism, there is nothing wrong, right? We're just dancing to the music of our DNA, to quote Richard Dawkins. There's nothing wrong. Well, I don't like that. That doesn't logically jive with me. There is stuff wrong. When kids are dying, when people are blowing other people up, I'm sorry, stuff is wrong. And stuff needs to be fixed, and we need an answer for it. I mean, even those who ascribe to that still use evil to try to argue against Christians. But you can't do that. if nothing's wrong or evil, right? Anyway, we also see a clear distinction here again between Christianity and the other monotheistic religion, Islam. That verse I read to you, the perfect basically goes before us, right? Jesus can do that because Jesus fulfills the law that we broke. Right. And he stands in our stead and he becomes our righteousness. But in many other religions, including Islam, you have to become your righteousness by following five pillars and ascribing the laws and living better than you live bad. And we all know that if that's what it's up to, is we got to be better than we are bad, we're in trouble. Yes. We know that. Yes. But the other problem is the prophet Muhammad, who was the only one to get the revelation of the laws that then you have to live by, didn't live by them himself. That's a problem. When the founder and the receiver of the laws then adjusts the laws when he breaks them. See, the Christian faith doesn't have anything like that in it. Jesus fulfills the law perfectly in our place so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. I want to be very clear today. I'm not saying, you know, I arrived at my faith in God because I wrote these down and took some classes. You know what I'm saying? Like, that sounds good, that sounds good, that sounds good. Got it. Now, some people come to faith that way. They really have these questions, and they search, and they find these are the most satisfactory. But that still doesn't save us. To agree that, hey, Christianity makes the most sense here, which it does. But that still doesn't save you. And this is where Christianity is unlike any other worldview. Because we're not just talking about a theory or answers to questions. We're talking about a personal God. Yes. And this is where it gets really good. Now, I'm just going to say this. If this doesn't help you, then throw it in the trash can. If it does, good, all right? Any test, I like logic, I like philosophy, right, Zach? We had good philosophical conversations this week. Any test for truth or test for a worldview comes in two tests. A correspondence test, like any statement or assumption of truth has to correspond with reality. And then the second test is coherence. All your statements, all your beliefs as a system must be coherent. Like they must make sense together. And under coherence, You have to have three things, and you have to have logical consistency, you have to have empirical adequacy, like you can be tested, and then you have to have experiential relevance, okay? So we can't contradict ourselves, like say there's a square circle, you know what I mean? Or like God made a rock, he couldn't move, same thing, you know what I'm saying? So it has to be logical, or we're not telling the truth. It has to be able to be tested, right? Did Jesus rise from the dead? They can test that. Is the Bible accurate and historical and archaeologically, you know, sound? Yeah, we've got all that. And then we have experiential relevance. And most of the New Age stuff that we, you know, hear about today only deals with experience. But you have to have all three, okay? Now, it's in the realm of experience where I really took the leap of faith for God. Now, I had all this stuff pounded in me as a kid. I went to church. You know, I knew about Jesus. But it wasn't until God began to meet me in these experiential ways that I began to back up and say, whoa. Yes, yes. Okay? And that is when I said, okay, you've got my attention. And so I may have wrestled with questions. They were there. I remember very vividly the verse that Jesus was coming back for a spotless bride haunted me. Like, I couldn't sleep over it. He's coming back for a spotless bride. I screwed up multiple times today. You know, like, that's what I used to think. I'm in trouble. Right. And so for a week, I'd be really good. I got to be spotless. You know, like, morally, you know, I'm just, like, scrubbing all week. And then when I screwed up, it's like, oh, he's coming back for people other than me. You know what I'm saying? And it haunted me. And then I begin to read the Bible continually, and I'm digging, I'm searching for the wrong reasons, because I'm trying to be spotless. And then I have these moments where I pull up in my driveway. I'm a high school student, and I try to get out of the car, and God would just say, wait. You know, and I'm like, what's going on? Like, I couldn't get out of the car. And I'd hear things like, you're holy. I'd hear things like, I love you. And I was like, okay. And then I'd hear again, like, you don't get it. I really love you. I'm having these thoughts. And man, I would begin to break down and just weep. Like, I couldn't get out of my car. And I'm just sobbing in my Jeep, you know, in my driveway, thinking logically, I just want to go inside and go to bed. But emotionally, just completely wrecked by this revelation that God would drop into me. You're striving, you're trying. I love you. I died for you. And these things would come to me. And it is in the experience of God speaking and meeting me to where I begin to really believe, God, you're real. And when you really believe that Jesus is your righteousness, and you really believe what he's done for you, then you're trapped in a, I'm going to turn my back on that and not believe it, or I'm going to throw my entire being into it. The only reasonable response is you can have all of me. Past, present, future, marriage, family, career, you can have it all. Because you purchased me. Because I'm made holy and righteous all because of you. The only reasonable response of love is just radical devotion. And I think the greatest act of love is to give somebody your will. God, you can have every decision. You can have me forever. I can't be spotless on my own. You make me spotless. And you can have everything then. Everything. In Psalm 8, says, Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory in the heavens. And looking at verse 4 or 3, says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them. To rephrase that, what is mankind that you would rescue us? What is it about mankind that God is so crazy about that he would do what he did to rescue us? I believe in God because of the uniqueness of the Christian message, which we call the gospel, to not only answer my questions, but to supply all my needs, even my felt needs. I believe in God because he does not give us a theory. John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave, not a theory, not a book, not five pillars, but he gave his son. He gave us a person. He gave us an individual, and he gave us access to a relationship. There is no other worldview that holds that. None. You know, at some point, the big buzzword today is skeptic. But you know that word means from a distance. At some point, the skeptic, maybe that's you, has to give up their distance to come close to a person. You see, you can study a book and a set of theories and rules from a distance all for your entire life. But at some point, see, to get to know my wife to the degree that I would get down on one knee and say, you and me forever, baby, I had to give up distance and get up in her life and get close to her and get to know her to decide whether I was going to commit to her or not. You see, if you stay a skeptic, then you'll always remain distant from the person of Jesus. And you've got to step close at some point. Some piece of evidence may take you closer, but at some point, you got to step all in and say, I want to know you, if you've made it possible to do so. I want to know you. And see, I believe in God ultimately because I met him. You could come in here today and you could say, you know what? Been doing a lot of studies on sociology or whatever. There's no Blake Dameron. And I would say, tell me more. And you would begin to lay out this eloquent, you know, dissertation of why there is no Blake Dameron exists. And I would say, I have one question for you. Have you met everybody, all 7 billion on the planet? No. Have you met everybody in history? No. You can't say that. And I would say, you know what? I believe there is a Blake Dameron. And they say, well, have you met everybody? I'd say, no. But I talk with him. I've met him. He's my friend. And so when you say, how could you say there's a God? Because I talk with him. Because I met him. He's my friend. And if you want to know God, you got to give up your distance. Maybe even some of your questions. Not all of them. Faith is not blind and unreasonable. But faith does say, I trust in what you've done for me. And I want to know you. Can we just pray this morning? Daryl, if you could come up for me.